Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Thank you all for coming to this midweek house program. House programs, generally we think that, well, it's a social come religious gathering in which there's some discussion of, at least in ISKCON house gatherings, we hope that there'll be some discussion of Krishna consciousness, Krishna conscious philosophy, and maybe a few jokes here and there, and everyone feels happy, and you take some prasadam, and that's it. And of course, kirtan. We had the kirtan already. Presentation today is going to be somewhat different. Some heavy topics. Krishna consciousness is, of course, heavy, inasmuch as Krishna is the heaviest. He's also the lightest. He is anaraniyan mahato mahiyan. He is the smallest, or smallest among all small things, and the greatest of all great things. I received an email a few days ago, which I'm going to read out and then address the contents of it, which are a challenge to the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. Now, that is there all around us all the time. We are not simply trying to spread some good vibes, but we wish to establish the truth of Krishna consciousness, the truth that if we are in Krishna consciousness, then we are properly situated. If we're not in Krishna consciousness in a manner that is favorable to Krishna, then we are improperly situated, and the result of that improper situation is punarapi jananam, punarapi maranam, punarapi janani jathare shayanam. Again and again getting born, again and again dying, and again lying in a mother's womb. In the propagation of the truth of Krishna consciousness, which is established particularly by Krishna himself in Bhagavad Gita, and ultimately throughout all the Vedic literature, we naturally come across many opposing ideas, and in fact we are surrounded by that in this world of untruth. And we may even subject ourselves to it, just as, for instance, I saw in the room there a book on, in some room here, I was wandering, chanting, finishing one round, a book on feminist ideology, which means that's definitely not going to help us make any advancement in Krishna consciousness, and in fact will fill our heads with various nonsense ideas that are prevalent in the world today. Of course, it's not the only, feminism is not the only nonsensism in the world today, but it's just one that happens to be prevalent. Of course, pure feminism means to worship Radha, but presumably in that book, which I didn't look inside, it's not promoting the worship of Radha, it's promoting an ideology based on the bodily concept of life, that I am this body, and if I'm in a woman's body, then kick the heads of those in men's body for all the troubles they've given to all the women over the centuries. There may be different versions of feminism, but anyway, that's one version of it. So the background to this email, which I received a few days ago, is as follows. It's a heavy email, and it warrants a heavy response. The background is this. I was advertised to give a lecture in an ISKCON center here in America. The lecture was to be in Bengali, so I spoke in Bengali. And members of the Bengali community in that area were invited. And then I also spoke for some time in English, because not everyone was there, and not everyone present there understood Bengali. I chose, the title given for the lecture was The Teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, or in Bengali, Sri Chaitanya Shikha. And I chose to speak on a verse which is by a descendant of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which encapsulates Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teachings. This Aradhyo Bhagavan Vrajesha Tanaya, etc., this verse. Which establishes Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teachings, which are different to other teachings. So people who are attached to other teachings might not be very happy to hear Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teachings. And as it happened, one elderly gentleman at the end of the lecture in the questions and answers session interjected the Yayata mang prapadyante tangs tataiva bhajami aham verse, and in which Krishna says, to render it in English for those of you who don't understand the meaning of this verse, as they, people in general, submit themselves to me, I similarly behave in reciprocation with them. So in my response to this, I cited some other Gita verses to counteract or refute the notion which is commonly associated with this verse that therefore, whatever you do, it's all okay. By citing, for instance, the verse, Yanti Deva Vrata Devan, those who worship demigods, they go to demigods. Pitrin Yanti Pritri Vrata Aha, those who worship forefathers go to the forefathers. Bhutani Yanti Bhuteja, those who worship ghosts become ghosts. And Madhyajina Opi Yanti Mam, and those who worship me, Krishna says, go to me. And I cited, although this gentleman hadn't done so, the famous saying of the person who is known in Bengal in particular as Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, Jato Mat Toto Pat, which is often translated to mean that all paths lead to the same goal. It's often understood to mean that. And I gave the example that this is incorrect according to Gita and even according to common sense. If you want to go to Seattle from, then you have to take the correct road. There's a particular road which goes there. If you instead take the road to Los Angeles, then you won't end up in the same place. So it's not that all paths are the same, even on the material platform, and what to speak of on the spiritual platform. And he disagreed with this and said, no, it's a misinterpretation. But he didn't press the point, and I didn't either. A few days later, I received an email from this gentleman as follows. I am the person who, quote, gave you trouble, unquote, last week when you spoke at the ISKCON temple, and I won't give the name of the place. I am writing this letter to give you a broader perspective that may help you in your future presentations. Let me tell you that I am a Bengali, and I also admired your command of the language. I agree with your assertion that one realizes Krishna only when approaches Krishna with the prema that the gopis had for him. My objection was that you gave only a partial view of the paths to God. Hinduism has two main sects, Vaishnava and Shaiva. Some Vaishnavas say that they are not Hindus, but then they lose their foundation. You mentioned the well-known shloka, Harenama, 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 Eva Kevalam, Kalau Nasceva, 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 Gati Ranyata. This is the path of bhakti, one of the four paths in Hinduism. And though this shloka is not mentioned in the Gita, it is given in the Brihadaranyaka Purana. But then one can invoke other Puranas, like Markandeya Purana, which has Chandi, or Devi Mahatmyam, which talks of God as the Mother Goddess. Actually, in Bengal, we have a belief that who is Kali is also Krishna. In my personal knowledge, devotees of Krishna and Kali live in the same family with perfect amity. Your words of derision of Jato Mot Toto Pot, portraying that it meant anything goes, was offensive to my sensibility, as it was to others as they spoke to me later after your talk. I believe you distorted the truth in those words uttered by Ramakrishna, whom many Hindus believe as a divine incarnation following Gauranga. Ramakrishna practiced Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism to see that all these religions were but different paths to God, the Satchidananda Brahman. Gandhi, who was a Vaishnava, did attest to that. Anyone who says that his path to God is the only path seems ignorant to me. We in Bengal have a saying, Vaishnav Vinay, meaning humility associated with Vaishnavism. I did not see any humility in you the other day, nor did I see any humility in Prabhupada, whom I personally saw when he came around 1972 to the University of Florida, where I was doing a PhD. That is where I heard him say that those who eat meat are like dogs. Religion cannot be relegated to the kitchen, as I said that day following your lecture. Actually, there is a bhajan by Mirabai, India's woman saint, in which she said that if eating fruit and vegetables made one a saint, then goats and monkeys would be saints. With due regard, so-and-so, Bengali Brahmin name, PhD, and lets me know that he's a retired, highly placed scientist in the Lockheed Company, which, as you know, is famous for manufacturing weapons and airplanes, such as the ones that America exports to Pakistan. All right, so what do we make of this? Now, you may wonder, well, why take it up? Why make an issue of it? Well, it's not a great issue. There are a few people here. There are a few people there. But these are the kind of issues that if we're going to preach Krishna consciousness, as Srila Prabhupada preached it, we are going to come up against. We have to come up against all the ideas of the world, which Krishna speaks in Bhagavad Gita to give us the clear perspective on reality. I might not have taken it up, but I thought I should respond to this idea that he says he didn't see any humility in Prabhupada. When I hear someone say, "You're not humble," it always strikes me as being contradictory. Because if someone says, "You're not humble," that means to say, "I'm humble and you're not." But it doesn't sound very humble to say so. I'm writing this letter to give you a broader perspective. In other words, I understand, you don't understand. As if I've never come across these things in my almost 40 years of speaking these things among Bengalis also. He's now going to instruct me. What's his qualification? He's a Brahmin by birth and a retired scientist, an elderly man. Let me tell you that I'm a Bengali. Well, that in itself is, if one identifies oneself first and foremost with the body that he's born in, well, according to Krishna, who I and pretty much anyone in the world would accept as a greater authority on spiritual knowledge than this gentleman. According to Krishna, yasyatma buddhi kunape tridhatuke swadhi kalatradishu bhoma ijyadhi yatirta salile yatirta buddhi salile nakarhijit janeshva bhigyeshu sa eva gokaraha. According to Krishna, this is from Bhagavat Purana, he says that a person who identifies himself with the body that he's presently inhabiting, which is, after all, composed of mucus, bile, and air, who thinks of the land in which in this present life he is born in is worshipable, who thinks that religious pilgrimage is complete simply by going to a holy place and taking a bath there, such a person is no more intelligent than an animal. That's what Krishna says. I agree with your assertion, as if, well, his agreeing makes it correct, but it's not my assertion, it's what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, that one realizes Krishna. Actually, I didn't say that. One realizes Krishna only when one approaches him with the prema that the gopis had for him. It's not only the gopis who can approach Krishna. There are many devotees in many there are devotees in Dwaraka, there are devotees in Vrindavan who are not gopis, there are many devotees who realize Krishna. So the point that in that verse is Ramya Kachetupasana Rajavadhuvargena Yakalpita. That the highest mode of worship of Krishna, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, is that of the gopis. My objection is that you gave only a partial view of the paths to God. Well, I didn't say that I was going to give a comprehensive one. I was asked to speak on Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teachings, which is that, based on Shastra, that Krishna is supreme. Hinduism has two main sects, Vaishnava and Shaiva. Well, so what? I didn't come in saying I was a Hindu, nor did Chaitanya Mahaprabhu say that he'd come to teach Hinduism. I came to this Krishna consciousness movement in search for the truth, for God, which I was fortunate enough to find the path for, being taught by Srila Prabhupada. Hinduism is a recent term, which was originally given by Muslims in a derogatory way to the people that they called Hindus, not having any other name for them. And later Hindus adopted that and said, Garv se kaho hum Hindu hai. Say it with pride, I am a Hindu. But it was originally a derogatory. Hey, you dog. And you go and call a person a dog, and he says, well, I'm a dog. I say, I'm a dog. And I say it proudly. But it's an insult. The term Hindu is meant as an insult for the particular kind of kafirs in the Muslim vocabulary who inhabited India. So Hinduism has two main sects, Vaishnava and Shaiva. It's interesting he divides it like that, as in Bengal, the two main divisions are Vaishnavas and Shaktas, or worship, as he mentions in here, worshippers of Shaktas, worshippers of Durga, and particularly in Bengal as the in the form of Kali. Of course, the Shakta sect of what can be called Hinduism is that can also be considered a subsect of the Shaiva sect, because Shakti is Shakti in this world is the wife of Shiva. Some Vaishnavas say they are not Hindus, but then they lose their foundation. Well, no, the foundation is Shastra, not some nebulous Hinduism. For Vaishnavas to identify themselves as Hindu is very problematic, just like then what we have to take what someone like this says. If we say we're Hindus, then we're all lumped in with Sai Baba and this Baba and that Baba and that Amar and this Upper and this Dada. There's some Dada Bhagavan in Gujarat. And there's so many Bhagavans and this Parivar and this, and so many ideas which are not based clearly on the teachings of Bhagavad Gita as it is. It becomes very problematic. Interestingly, this gentleman seems to be a fan of Ramakrishna. The Ramakrishna Mission fought in court to be established as non-Hindu, and they won the case. So they're officially non-Hindu, whatever that means. I don't know if anyone ever established what it actually means to be a Hindu, but officially, legally, the Ramakrishna Mission is non-Hindu. For some reason, they wanted, I think it was something to do with certain advantages that non-Hindu organizations get over Hindus. So I mentioned the well-known, he says that I mentioned the well-known shloka, Haren Nama, Haren Nama, Haren. Yeah, the Hindu word, by the way, just to get back to that, is you won't find anywhere in Vedas, Mahabharata, Vedanta Sutra, anywhere in the Puranas, in Bhagavad Gita. It's a relatively modern term. It's not a Shastric term. It has nothing to do with the ancient culture and teachings of Shastra. So I mentioned the well-known shloka, Haren Nama, Haren Nama, Haren Nama, Eva Kevalam, Kalona, Stevana, Stevana, Steva, Gatir, Anyata. This is the path of bhakti, one of the four paths in Hinduism. Again, there's a problem with that, because bhakti is described in Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam and other Shastras, and never anywhere does it say that it's anything to do with Hinduism. Nor anywhere does it say that it's one of the four paths of Hinduism. And though this shloka is not mentioned in the Gita, it's given in the Brihadaranyaka Purana. All right, very good. But then one can invoke other Puranas, like Markandeya Purana, in which there's the Chandi, or glorification of Devi, Devi Mahatmyam. You can do, but nevertheless, Brihadaranyaka Purana says, Haren Nama, Haren Nama, Haren Nama Eva Kevalam. It doesn't say only for bhaktas. But it says that to achieve the goal, there is no other way than chanting the names of Hari. So others, parts of Shastra may be there. Krishna refers to that in Bhagavad Gita, for instance, by saying, Antavattu palangte shantad bhavatyalpamedhasam, which means that those who worship other gods, they achieve only temporary boons, and therefore they're not very intelligent. That's what Krishna says about worshipping various demigods. Actually, in Bengal, we have a belief. So what in Bengal you have a belief? So many people have so many beliefs. Why? Because someone in Bengal believes something, is that supposed to be... Why should that be considered authoritative? We accept what Shastra says. There are so many beliefs. There were people in India, Hindus, who used to worship Kali and kill others and rob them. They were called the Tuggies, and the British wiped them out. So they believed that they were doing it under the blessing of the goddess. So, because they believed it, is it something good that we should accept? There are many people who believe that Sai Baba is God. There's absolutely no Shastric basis for that. It's just some foolish belief. Just because someone believes it, should we accept it? There was a Life Insurance Corporation officer in Chennai who some 20, 25 years ago decided that this job was very boring and declared himself to be Kalki Avatar. Many people believe him. So what they believe him? Does it make him an avatar because he hoodwinks them and they're so foolish to believe it? So we have a belief that Kali is also Krishna. Well, in one sense, everything is non-different from Krishna, but in another important sense, everything is different from Krishna. And the worship of Kali, as Krishna states in Bhagavad Gita in several ways, in several places, the worship of demigods does not lead to the same result as worshiping Krishna. In my personal knowledge, devotees of Krishna and Kali live in the same family with perfect amity. That's besides the point. Your words of derision of Jato Mot Toto Pot portraying that it meant anything goes was offensive to my sensibility. Well, sorry about that, but we're not out to offend people in particular, as you seem to be, sir, but we have to speak what is correct, and we have to distinguish reality from illusion for the benefit of others. Otherwise, people are in Maya. How are they going to come out of Maya? They have to know what is the truth. I'll take questions, comments, and protests afterwards. So, portraying that it meant anything goes, well, it's not a, this is not a, for a start, this saying, jato mat tato pat, is not according to Shastra. It directly contradicts Krishna's statement in Bhagavad Gita that yanti deva vrata devan, this verse I just quoted, that the different methods of worship lead to different goals, to different places. And Krishna's statement, mam ekam sharanam raja, surrender to me only. And factually, we don't see anyone becoming spiritually advanced by saying this. We see that we don't see people becoming spiritually advanced according to the symptoms derived from Shastra described by Srila Rupa Goswami and Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, although there may be some imitation of that, which is imitation symptoms, which is also described in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He refers to Ramakrishna, whom many Hindus believe as a divine incarnation following Gauranga. Yeah, and many people believe that Mahababa is an incarnation. Many people believe that Sai Baba number one is an incarnation. Many people believe that Sai Baba number two is an incarnation. Many people, when I first came to India in the mid-1970s, believed Mahatma Gandhi was an incarnation of God. It was very common to see his picture on people's altars. It's practically vanished now. Nowhere, you never hear anyone talking about Mahatma. Do you remember seeing it in your youth? As a child, you used to see it. It's gone. Nowadays. Lal Bahadur Shastri, another incarnation. Was it? I didn't hear of that. Gandhi was famous. No, you used to see the picture of Pandit Nehru, but not worshipped as an incarnation. But Gandhi was considered by many to be an incarnation. Many people in Gujarat consider Sahajanand Swami, otherwise known as Swami Narayan, to be an incarnation. And there are incarnations here, there, and everywhere. If you go, at the latest count I heard, there were 300 present so-called incarnations of God in India. But that people believe it doesn't make them an avatar. We have to judge from Shastra. Then he goes on, this gentleman goes on to state, Ramakrishna practiced Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism to see that all these religions were but different paths to God. Yeah, well, there's a major problem in that, because in his following of Islam, because Muslims do that, he also ate beef. Now, that's among Hindus or among followers of the Vedic culture considered to be something very wrong. And in fact, at least in the past, that was a cause of Hindu-Muslim riots. If Hindus wanted to upset Muslims, they'd throw some pork into the masjid, and if the Muslims wanted to bait the Hindus, they'd throw some beef into the temple. And it still goes on, actually, even up to the present day. Just a few years ago when I was in Udupi, there'd been a major problem because some Muslims had killed some cows and strewn them around the streets. So there's some serious problems there. And anyway, I won't get into that too much. Gandhi, who was a Vaishnava, well, was he a Vaishnava? According to the strict definition, no. Maybe you could say he was socially a Vaishnava. Apparently his mother was a Vaishnava and he got his vegetarianism from that. Anyone who says that his path to God is the only path seems ignorant to me. Again, setting himself up as the, he doesn't say according to Shastra, he doesn't quote Bhagavad Gita, according to me. Well, I'm not sure if I did say in that lecture that it's the only path, but Krishna himself says in Bhagavad Gita, Bhaktya Mama Vijanati, Krishna establishes himself in Bhagavad Gita as the highest truth. For instance, by saying, Matath Parataram Nanyat, there is no one higher than me. Aham Sarvasya Prabhavaha, everything comes from me. Aham hi adir devanam, I am the origin of all the demigods, and so on. So Krishna establishes himself as the supreme, and he says, Bhaktya mam abhijanati, I can be fully known by bhakti. So other paths may be accepted as stepping stones, but the path of bhakti as taught by Krishna and later by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the definitive path for attaining God. We in Bengal have a saying, again, does that make it authoritative because some Bengali said, Vaishnav Vinay, meaning, well, I do understand Bengali, meaning humility associated with Vaishnavism. I did not see any humility in you the other day, nor did I see any humility in Prabhupada, whom I personally saw when he came around 1972 to the University of Florida, where I was doing a PhD. No, you won't see humility, sir, because you don't know how to see it. You don't know what is the humility of a Vaishnava. For instance, the humility of Hanuman in burning Lanka, that was his humility, his total submission to Lord Rama, manifested as his enmity toward the enemies of Rama. Humility doesn't mean, as is understood in the worldly sense, that you just, well, whatever anyone does or says, yes, yes, all right, very nice. But humility means to serve Krishna and the Vaishnavas and help them in their mission of, as a servant, take a role in their mission of propagating the actual truth distinguished from illusion for the benefit of all. The actual truth being that we are all Mamai Vangsho Jiva Loki Jiva Bhuta Sanatanaha. We are all eternally part and parcel of Krishna, but Mana Shashtan Indriyani Prakriti Sthani Karshati. We are all struggling in this material world with the six senses headed by the mind. So to give people that knowledge is the humility of a Vaishnava. The humility of a Vaishnava is that he thinks himself very fallen and lowly, but he doesn't avoid the service of Krishna. Just like Arjuna was propagating a sentimental idea of humility, but Krishna told him to fight, and Arjuna was humble enough to accept Krishna's order to fight. He submitted himself to Krishna. For this gentleman to say he doesn't see any humility in Prabhupada is very dangerous for him, and it really is the cap on this whole condescending letter, that he thinks that he's in a position to criticize Srila Prabhupada and say that he doesn't find any Vaishnav humility in Srila Prabhupada, who's spread Vaishnavism all over the world. He says, or he recalls that the University of Florida is where I heard him say that those who eat meat are like dogs. Of course, we don't have the exact statement of what Srila Prabhupada said. But presuming that Srila Prabhupada did say that, and he did make similar statements on numerous occasions, it is a supportable statement, because dogs eat meat. It's not necessary for humans to do so. What to speak of religion, it is among any enlightened person or somewhat considerate person, to eat meat which is produced from factory farms which engage in the lifelong torture of animals and birds and then slaughtering them so that people can eat them. This means taking part in extreme and unnecessary cruelty. So how can anyone condescend to pontificate to others when they're engaged in, if they think that meat eating is something defensible? Of course, meat eating is allowed in Vedic culture under certain circumstances, but not in the present way that it goes on in the modern world, where animals and birds are, by the millions, are tortured. It's an ongoing holocaust. The animals and birds are tortured throughout their whole life and then slaughtered mercilessly. So anyone who wants to defend this cannot be said to have even a basic quality of even any slight compassion. Their consciousness is polluted. Then religion cannot be relegated to the kitchen. Well, so it's like a dog. A dog, that's the food for a dog, but a human's food, human doesn't require to eat that. So for a human to eat meat just for the pleasure of the tongue, inflicting torture on and murder on others, that is subhuman, surely. So to criticize someone as pointing that out to others so that they can reform their lives. Most people never think about it. It's most people, they just take it as normal because everyone else is eating meat and they eat meat and they don't see the animal being slaughtered. They don't think about it. So in some sense, we may not blame them so much. But then Srila Prabhupada is bringing their attention to this point for their own benefit. And to criticize Srila Prabhupada for doing that is certainly a great offense. Religion cannot be relegated to the kitchen. But actual religion is all-pervading in all aspects of life. It's not absent from the kitchen. And eating is, in all religious processes throughout the world, there should be some restrictions on eating. It's not that you can just eat anything. And particularly in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Patrang pushpang palang toryam yome bhaktya prayachati tadahang bhakti uparitam ashnami prayatatmanaha. If Krishna says, if one offers me leaf, flower, fruit or water with bhakti, then I will accept it. Prayatatmanaha means following all the rules and regulations concerned for doing so. So religion is very much in the kitchen. It's not only in the kitchen, but it's not just some Bengali belief also. It should pervade all aspects of life. There is a bhajan by Mirabai in which she says that if eating fruit and vegetables made one a saint, then goats and monkeys would be saints. All right, very good. But I didn't say that eating vegetables make you a saint, so it's irrelevant in this context. It's not simply that by eating fruit, one becomes a saint, but if one eats for the pleasure of the tongue, and especially if one eats for the pleasure of the tongue, food that is produced by inflicting gross suffering on other living beings, then he certainly cannot be a saint. You get the point? It's not simply that by eating vegetables, one becomes a saint, but by partaking in the gross cruelty that is involved in animal slaughter, one is certainly debarred from being a saint. So there are a few points. These again, if we're going to speak the message of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then we can expect all kinds of opposition from all kinds of ideas, which are all summarized by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, in which he says, Namang dushkushino murha prapadyante naradhamaha maya parita jnana asurang bhavamashritaha. Krishna says that four kinds of impious people do not surrender to me. Impious, he used the word dushkriti, which means that they may be very expert in various activities, but they're sinful. So he includes among such persons mudha, people who are simply foolish, simply working, and no higher goal of life. Then naradhama, people who are considered very highly placed in human society, but because they have no inclination to Krishna consciousness, or their level of consciousness is very low, they're not inclined to surrender to Krishna. And we see that practically the big leaders of corporations and big politicians, their level of consciousness is very low. They're not cultivating higher consciousness, what to speak of Krishna consciousness. Maya parita jnana, I mean someone who is in worldly terms very learned, but whose actual understanding of reality is covered by illusion. And then there is the asura bhavam ashrita, one who is just out and out demonic, just wicked through and through. So these are four basic categories of people who do not surrender to Krishna. In the teachings of Prahlad Maharaj, as he was addressing the archetypal atheist and demon Hiranyakashipu, who happened to be his father, he also touched on this subject by saying, Matir nakrishne paratasvatova mitho bibhadyeja grihavratanam adanta gobhivishatang tamisram punaf punas charvita charvananam. He said that persons who have as if made a vow to not surrender to Krishna, they won't surrender to Krishna because that's their that is their determination. Either they may think, I'm looking for the truth, I'm very religious, but they're determined not to surrender to Krishna. They may even have meetings in which they discuss philosophy and this and that, but or they may come in contact with devotees of Krishna who very reasonably and straightforwardly explain the truths of Krishna consciousness, understood through Shastra, but they won't accept it because they are determined to enjoy their senses. All these so-called philosophies come down to sense enjoyment, ultimately, by which they must enter into hell, and then they must suffer for doing so, and they get born again and again to chew the chewed again and again. They've already enjoyed sense gratification so many lives, but they go on trying to get some pleasure out of it. So we don't expect to convince people such as those who have views such as have been expressed in this letter, but we should be able to reply to them others who may be influenced by this, but who are not so much against Krishna consciousness, we should be able to convince them. Of course, this gentleman would say, well, I'm not against Krishna consciousness, but he has his own definition of it. For instance, he considers himself to be better than Srila Prabhupada, which is patently absurd, even if he is a PhD, which won't help you in spiritual understanding. All right, so you had a question, comment, or protest, which you've...
A couple of comments and a couple of questions.
Yeah, okay. excuse me, let me just let out a little cough here.
So in relation to the person who's writing that letter, in the upper class of Hindu for a while, or in India for a while, there was a big push for focusing on social harmony, combining all the different elements in people's philosophy into something that can work together. And that seems to be the primary focus that this person has in a lot of different elements.
Not okay,
so much religious as social cohesion.
Shall I comment on that?
Yeah,
okay. Socially, if it's examined, Ramakrishna's Jato Mot Toto Pot can be seen as an attempt to bring all classes of Hindus and non-Hindus together, although it hasn't really succeeded much in bringing non-Hindus. It's actually just as what usually happens, whether it's within Christianity or whatever, whenever people try to make a new harmonizing endeavor, they actually just set up another sect. That's what actually happens. one more to add to the stew. So there was some idea like that as Hindus found themselves to be under attack, so to speak, from, oh, this is quite a big topic, from Western triumphalism, that our Christianity is very, your Krishna is very bad, he runs around with women, and our Jesus is very good, and he's the Prince of Peace, and your Krishna is making war, so our Christianity is better, our science is better. So Hinduism found itself under attack, and various responses to that during the 19th century. And prior to that, in Bengal especially, and on the west, northwest of India, many lower caste Hindus had converted to Islam, thinking that by doing so they would enter into an equal relationship, because theoretically all Muslims are the same, although to the present day there are many Muslims who identify themselves as Brahmin Muslims and will not intermarry with non-Brahmin Muslims. Same in Christianity, with converted Christians. So there was a lot of pressure socially, and the British were also very dismissive of the caste system, although in their own country, certainly at that time especially, there was very much the upper class and the lower classes. And so there was a lot of hypocrisy in that, but the different groups came out, such as the Arya Samaj in Bengal, the Brahmos, who said that they're a new religion, combining elements of Christianity and Hinduism, for want of a better term, but which has become practically insignificant, and Brahmos are generally considered to be part of Hinduism nowadays. So then there came the Ramakrishna Mission. These are different attempts to bring everyone together and let's all be friends and stop arguing with each other. But there were serious problems in that. For instance, Ramakrishna's eating beef did not sit well with Orthodox Hindus. And the fact that most of the followers of the Ramakrishna Mission, who got this idea that religion cannot be relegated to the kitchen, were at least fish eaters, if not chicken eaters or mutton eaters, if not beef eaters, that also didn't sit well with many people outside of Bengal. And actually the Ramakrishna Mission in South India, the sannyasis there, they're all vegetarian, because if there were meat-eating sannyasis in South India, it wouldn't go down well at all. So it may have been an attempt to bring everyone together, but it didn't succeed. So there's so many things could be said, but we didn't talk too much about that. Yeah, then?
I was a little confused when he said that bhakti was just one of four paths. Mm. But after a while, as you were talking about it, it occurred to me, so anybody else knows, it's not
the four paths, yeah.
He's talking about
Vivekananda. No, he's talking about karma, the four paths, karma, jnana, yoga, and bhakti. Although yoga is often included within jnana. So Krishna does...
Mystical. The yoga, when they talk about it, they mean
Vajrayoga,
mystical.
Yeah, Ashtanga yoga. But that's often included within jnana, because its ultimate goal is generally the same. So these paths are mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, but Krishna clearly say, if Bhagavad Gita is understood as it is, as Srila Prabhupada entitled his edition, which shocked me the first time I saw it, or or bemused me the first time I saw it, because I thought, what does it mean, Bhagavad Gita? When you go to a store to buy apples, you say, can I have apples? And someone says, this is a real apple, an apple as it is. And if it's an apple, it's an apple. If it's Bhagavad Gita, it should be Bhagavad Gita. That's what I thought. But then I understood that many editions of Bhagavad Gita present the interpreter's view and not that what Krishna states. But if we take Bhagavad Gita as it is, it's abundantly clear that Krishna establishes himself as the supreme and bhakti to him as the highest path. And in fact, Arjuna even asks about that at the beginning of the 12th chapter. And but anyway, Krishna says, yogi, after saying to Arjuna at the end of the sixth chapter, tasmat yogi bhav Arjuna, Arjuna, you should become a yogi. But then Krishna says, yogi nam api sarvesham madgatena antaratmana shraddhavan bhajate yomam samayukta tamo mataha. Krishna says, yes, there is karma yoga, there is jnana yoga, there is ashtanga yoga, but Krishna says, among all the yogis, the best, Krishna says, is one who worships me with great faith. So it's not that Krishna says that all the paths are the same, which is a common misinterpretation of Krishna's teachings in the Bhagavad Gita by people who don't want to surrender to Krishna, because they fall in the category of duskritis, of... It's a sinful inclination, actually, if we are to be straightforward about it. Yeah, let's go on with your points, and then we can go on to other ones.
In terms of the sampradayas, which I tried to interpret it as originally, are all four sampradayas bhakti sampradayas?
Are all four sampradayas bhakti sampradayas? You may have heard of four sampradayas. There are, in this Kali Yuga, there are four bhakti sampradayas which are prominent in this world. There are other sampradayas also. Also accepted as a Vedic sampradaya, at least by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is the Shankara sampradaya, which is impersonalistic. But it's accepted as a Vedic sampradaya because Shankara, he at least nominally accepted the Vedas. And he taught to follow Vedic practices. Otherwise, used generally, the term sampradaya can refer to all kinds of... But the more common word is pantha, or pant in modern Hindi. Just like Kabir pant, Sikh pant, and so on. Which means paths, practically. Anyway, this is all technical stuff. Then yourself?
Could you give a word for word for that Ramakrishna saying?
Jato mat tato pat. Do you know Hindi? No. Who speak, you all speak Hindi? It's jitna mat itna pat. As many opinions, that many paths. That's what it means. Which comes down to, well, any opinion is as good as any other, in four words, it nullifies the authority of Shastra. If you take it seriously, which we shouldn't. Why is Ramakrishna all of a sudden supposed to be some authority? What is his authority? In Vedic culture, one derives authority from quoting Shastra. But this is just his opinion. And as I said to that gentleman that evening, well, if you take that all paths are equally good, well, all opinions are equally good, then my opinion is that your opinion is bogus. So, this statement cannot stand logically. Just by that example, it cannot stand logically, because if you say all opinions are equally good, then my opinion is that all opinions are not equally good. So it cannot stand a simple, logical analysis. I never speak the truth. I'm just saying this as another example of a statement that cannot logically stand. If that statement is true, it's untrue. And if it's not true, it's untrue. So if I say I never speak the truth, it's a self-defeating statement. Then what else were you going to say?
A question. We're told that for those who worship Shiva Mahashiva as the grantor of boons, they go and they take on these deformed bodies and all that. But those who worship him as Supreme Lord go to Krishna.
Those who worship Shiva as the Supreme Lord go to Krishna. You were told that. What's the Shastric basis of that statement? I can't either.
Okay.
I also don't know what the Shastric basis of it, because I don't find it in Shastra.
I do remember hearing recently that
Krishna, I already quoted this in the course of this talk, that Krishna says, Yanti Deva Vrata Devan, those who worship various demigods, they go to the demigods. Madhyajin Opi Yanti Mam, those who worship me go to me. So if you worship Shiva, you don't go to Krishna. You have to worship Krishna to go to Krishna. One can, as subsidiary to his worship of Krishna, worship Shiva as a great Vaishnava, but not as the Supreme Lord, independent of Krishna. It's a great science. We should understand it. Most of the Hindus, for want of a better term, in this country, are highly educated in material subjects, but highly uneducated in spiritual subjects. So I suggest that you apply your God-given intelligence to understand this most important of subjects, because you may have a big house and lots of money, but at the time of death, it won't help you in the slightest. And it might even be a cause of your getting born again due to attachment to it, as we understand from Bhagavad Gita. Yes. So, your question, please.
Maharaj, can you please spend just a few minutes to speak about your background, how you learned about
Krishna? My background, how I came to Krishna consciousness. Well, it's described in one of my books that devotees often ask me about my life prior to coming to Krishna consciousness. I was a dog in human form. That sums it up. And there's no real need to get into so many details. I was wandering in this material world, suffering birth after birth. Srila Prabhupada kindly picked me up. And I was born in England, dysfunctional family, went to school, nothing in particular to say. I wasn't a serial killer, or a great football player, nothing worth talking about, except Prabhupada's mercy. Srila Prabhupada's mercy is the only thing of any significance in my life. Not only in this life, but life after life. Jotamar Tottabot doesn't actually nullify Shastra, but it seeks to. It cannot nullify Shastra. I should qualify that statement.
But it also makes nonsense of any material laws also. If people can, whatever they want to do, that is my opinion.
Yeah, even materially it doesn't work. If you drive in Texas without a seatbelt and the police stop you and say, well, in my opinion, and you say, you can have your opinion, but in my opinion, you have a $250 fine. Just to lighten up a little bit here, there's an interesting anecdote from merry old England in which a person was sent a ticket for dodging a light with a photo of him doing so and given a £10 fine. They don't find them so much in England. £10 or whatever. So he sent back a photo of a £10 note. And he got back in the post a photo of a pair of handcuffs. And he paid the bill. Well, I heard in California mostly people don't pay their their speeding bills. They just don't bother. And there are so many people who don't pay that the cops can't keep up with it. So they mostly get away with it. Anyway, I'm not recommending that you break the law. But this, as you rightly point out, it could be given as a supposed justification even for breaking the material laws. Or if you go into, the child goes to school and they get taught 2 + 2 = 4. Well, I have a different opinion. I think 2 + 2 = 5. And the world doesn't work like that. It doesn't, as you rightly point out, it doesn't make sense even materially. Yes.
Thank you for the class, Maharaj. I kind of brought up a lot of thoughts in my mind. You know, one of the things which came up was this business of quoting from different shastras. So, when there are so many shastras.
Oh, yes, that's a very good point you're bringing up. Please continue, yeah.
Christians will say, Jesus Christ said, I'm the only way. And we say, okay, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, there's no other way, no other way, no other way. And each, the demigod says, and they're saying, I am the Supreme.
Mm.
So, it kind of gets very confusing.
You're another kind of man. Everything's kind of. Okay, go on.
So it gets pretty confusing to...
Not kind of confusing.
How to clearly...
Well, you're talking about on book distribution. On book distribution, it's usually best not to get into... Although this might seem counterintuitive, it's usually best not to get into philosophical discussions. Somehow, if you can charm people to take the book, let Srila Prabhupada do the talking.
Hmm.
Otherwise, they'll go on and... And another point is that very few people in the present age, from what I've seen, they're even capable of clear philosophical discussion. And they'll brazenly talk nonsense. And because of the influence of such ideas like this, which have wafted over to the Western Hemisphere, that all opinions are the same, and it's all... an important point which I did mean to make, and thank you for bringing up this point, is that actually to get into all the points that he's raised would require a very deep philosophical discussion. First of all, on epistemology, is what is the basis of everything that we say? He seems to think that. Bengali folklore is the standard of spiritual knowledge. So to get into all these points in detail would require very deep philosophical discussion. But generally, people who are attracted to slogans like this "Jato Mat Tato Pat," all is one. Usually, such people are not interested in any serious philosophical discussion or anything, any serious search for understanding of reality, of truth, distinguished from illusion. Mostly their religiousness is some kind of cover for their gross materialism. And that's true of most people who subscribe to any religious path. Why are people attracted to... For instance, there's one woman from South India who goes all around the world, and people come and hug her. Thousands of people come. Why do they? It makes them feel good. But they feel good. Okay, well, so what? But what is the purpose of life? And why am I in this material world which is full of suffering? Such so-called gurus, they never discuss such points. Let alone give any answer. So really, this Krishna consciousness is meant for people who are most sincere to get free from birth and death, to understand this world as a place of suffering, and to go beyond that, to surrender to Krishna, to focus their love on Krishna, who is the proper receptacle of that love. So sincere, actually sincere people may be very few. We build temples and on festival days like Janmashtami, we can expect many Hindus to visit because they're Hindus. And it's what they do on Janmashtami. But actual serious practice of Krishna consciousness, we don't expect so many people to take it up very seriously. Most people take things like going to football games and barbecues more seriously than becoming free from birth and death and understanding the actual purpose of life. Sad but true, yeah.
Just a comment on the wording of purpose question. Just for clarity, as far as I know, Jesus never said that he was the only way. He said he was the way in terms of guru.
In John, it's translated like that. Jesus said that I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to God but through me, according to present translations of John in the epistle of Saint John. Although in the previous, John was the last of the, sorry, the Gospels. In the, John was the last of the Gospels. None of them were written during Christ's lifetime, and that it only appears in that Gospel. But apparently, according to some scholars, the way it's written that this statement is made in the, now my ignorance of grammar is coming through, in the present tense, the present, what's that called? Any idea? It means right now. That means, if, is it present perfect? Okay, thank you. I should have stayed awake in my grammar classes in school. It's like saying something like, if I were to say, I have a cough, that statement is true now, but it's not true for the next 2,000 years. So apparently this statement was made in the present perfect, in whatever language it was. The Gospels, I believe, were written in Greek, and Jesus spoke in Aramaic. So in the original Greek, which got translated into Latin and then into English, it was like that, that probably in Palestine at that time, Jesus was the only way, but that's not sinister. I had this question being raised as a Christian, and I suppose that many people being raised as Christians in the modern Western world also have the question, because at that time, in the 1960s, when I was becoming a little aware of the world more than simply what I have to eat and just the immediate world around me, I became aware that there are various religions throughout the world, some of which predated Christianity, and it just struck me that, well, all these people, they're also talking about God, and how is it that all of a sudden Jesus pops up in one remote corner of the world, and he's the only way for everyone in all times and all places and all circumstances. So that doesn't, does that mean that the highly developed theology of Vaishnavism, it's all bogus? Well, that's what certain Christians would tell us, but it doesn't seem to make any sense, seeing as, certainly the theology of Vaishnavism is far more developed and sophisticated than that of Christianity. So the statement that Jesus is the only way, if it's taken literally in the sense that literalist Christians, especially here in America, there are many such persons do, doesn't present Jesus in a very good light, actually. Yeah, you were going to say something else? No.
I was, yes. Mm. So when there's different religions that say seemingly similar things, such as I'm the only way, and another religion says I'm the only way, what is the proper way in which we are to help sift through all the different...
How can you understand who is speaking the truth when they all say I'm the only way? That was my question when I came to the Hare Krishna temple. Everyone says their way is the only way. But Krishna doesn't say that in Bhagavad Gita. He does say that ultimately he is to be reached by bhakti, But he also describes that there are stepping stones toward that. Karma, jnana, yoga are stepping stones toward that. So this idea, this is the only way, that may be helpful for persons who are not very developed and to fix them in their path. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that yo-yo yang-yang tanang bhakta shraddhayachatam icchati tasya tasyachalang shraddham tameva vidadhamyaham. Krishna says that someone who wants to dedicate themselves to a certain demigod, I give them the immovable faith. I give it. Krishna, as Paramatma, in everyone's heart, he gives the immovable faith by which they think that this demigod is all in all and is the best. And that can be understood to be applied to full faith in Islam, whichever branch of Islam you may be in, or in Christianity, in whichever branch of Christianity you may be. The Jehovah's Witnesses, we're the only ones, and all the others are going to hell. It may be applied to atheism, to communism. People feel the need for some focus in their life, and Krishna provides that. But it's those who are on the Vedic path, they can make a better advancement toward the goal. Krishna also provides the faith to the atheists, but that doesn't help them to make any spiritual advancement.
A comment on the second part of this question. I'm not sure you meant this, but this is what I heard. As far as I understand it, Gauranga Mahaprabhu never said that he was the only path. He said that in Kali Yuga, chanting the holy names is the only way.
In Kali Yuga, chanting the holy names is the only way. That's according to Shastra. For attaining the highest level of God realization, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's path is the only path. But there are other very high levels of God realization that may be attained by other paths also. There's Shiv Puran, Markandeya Puran. These within the Shastra, these particular Puranas are stated to be for persons who are in the lower modes of nature, Tamoguna. So there are different Puranas. There are 18 Mahapuranas, among which 6 are for persons in Sattvaguna, 6 for persons in Rajoguna, and 6 for persons in Tamoguna. So one way in which Krishna makes faith in different demigods strong is to provide shastras which say that, for instance, Shiva is supreme. But then, like I say, if we're going to get into this, then we have to get into a lot of epistemology. But then we see that in Shiva, that Shiva worship, that has characteristics of tamoguna, as described in Bhagavad Gita. So how can we, which is the lowest mode, jaganya guna vrittisto, adhoga chanti tamasaha. It's an abominable mode, Krishna says, which takes one into darkness. So anyway, it's a big topic to understand all these points in great detail.
Spiritual knowledge will. But what about everything in between? How will genuine spiritual knowledge, how does that relate to anything else we do?
Material knowledge will not help us at the time of death. Spiritual knowledge will not. And what about anything in between? Can you define what you mean by that which is in between?
In other words, how does spiritual knowledge relate to everything else we do?
Oh, yeah, that reminds me. The point of social amalgamation. I think you raised that point. That's already there in Shastra. That's given in Bhagavad Gita. It's called the Varnashram system, in which people are supposed to, according to their guna and karma, their inclination, which they've received from previous lives, and their inclination, their outlook, their mentality, their proclivity to work, not according to janma, not according to their birth. People are engaged in different occupations, and they're supposed to cooperate for the service of Krishna. This is Krishna's social harmony program, which had been hijacked and converted into the caste system. On the basis of birth, people claim superiority over others. And even though brahmanas, they are supposed to be superior to others, but it's not meant to be exploitive. One in a superior position is supposed to act for the benefit of others. The idea of social harmony in which everyone is equal can never work. It's impossible. There always have to be leaders in human society. Even in democracy, which is theoretically the rule of the people, there's a chief executive in this country, the president of the state, whose role, whose privilege, whose power is clearly far greater than that of any one of you in this room who might have voted for him. So the Vedic system accepts the reality that there are people on different levels of capability and seeks to stratify them for cooperation on the material platform. That means working to produce the necessities of life, which in pre-industrial civilization meant a much simpler endeavor than at the present time. But then everyone is to cooperate on the platform of service to Krishna. That's the cooperation point. So that's Krishna's social harmony program, and that's the interface between spiritual and material. Spiritual knowledge is translated into life in this world via the Varnashram system, which is also meant for elevating people gradually, and those, especially the more intelligent people, giving them spiritual knowledge, the distinction between matter and spirit, and for all classes of people, engaging them in Krishna consciousness, or for some in demigod worship, that's also within the Vedic culture, although it's not the highest level. That is done by temples, just like I said, people go to the temple on Janmashtami, they may not be very serious about spiritual life, but that is, if they go to the temple, that's for their benefit. Then in traditional Vedic culture, instead of watching TV or things on the internet, there'll be dramas and recitations of Krishna Leela and Rama Leela. This is all described actually in this book, Glimpses of Traditional Indian Life. And in this way, the culture is God-centered. Sve sve kamanya bhirata sangsidhim lapate naraha. Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, after describing the four basic groupings, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, within Varnashram society, says that everyone, by assiduously performing their specific work, can attain the highest perfection.
Also, the verse in Bhagavad Gita on Raja Vidyam, Raja Vidyam. So it may appear that there's so many different paths just within the Vedic tradition, and how is it that Krishna consciousness, you know, within Bhagavad Gita is the ultimate path? How does one stumble upon that? Krishna says,
there's another instance, yeah, Raja Vidya Raja Kuhyam, at the beginning of the ninth chapter, Krishna, in which Krishna describes bhakti yoga and the perils of not being a devotee. So that's there also. Hare Krishna. I think we'll finish there now. Thank you for patiently listening. Hare Krishna.